Okay, good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming here. And I would like to express my gratitude to the organizers of this wonderful meeting. And maybe that's not the most traditional way to start the DFT conference with front of Monte Carlo, but since Karen said yesterday that DFT is something like connection of two words of DFT and crisis in one sentence, I don't think that it's true. But anyway, this might be an interesting another view on how to do the electronic structure calculations. Let me acknowledge people which really worked in the project which I will mention, which was Indra Kolorange, who is now a von Humboldt Fellow, and he's at the University of Hamburg now, and Michael Beide, who is now at Oak Ridge. These were two wonderful postdocs which left just this summer. Okay, so let's start.
Should we dim the lights a little bit?
Is it visible enough, or should we dim the lights more? Anyway, let me just continue. I believe that it's reasonable. So what is quantum Monte Carlo? Just in a nutshell, to say a few words. Basically, what you do is the following. You take any trial wave function within the given symmetry class, and you apply this operator where this is Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian can be almost anything what we want, fully interacting, and tau is a real parameter, we can call it an imaginary time. We know that if we apply this, this will exponentially suppress all the excitations which contaminate the trial wave function, and will end up at the ground state within the given symmetry class. How you do that in practice, a little bit adjusted, we go into the real space representation and rewrite it in integral form. So you have this Green's function here, and basically you go in iterative way of substituting this thing in here and getting in the next the time slice tau t plus tau. And here I kind of sneaked in the important sampling so that we are looking not only for the phi 0r, which is our presumable ground state within the given symmetry class, but the product of the trial wave function with the phi, which is the solution. The reason is, there are several reasons for that. It improves the efficiency of the whole process, and also there is a fundamental point with the fermion nodes. Now, how this can be solved and how you do that? Well, you see that this is kind of a propagation type of an equation. You take something which you know in time t, and then you get something which is in t plus tau, imaginary time, and it's done by propagating it with this kernel, which is nothing else but exponentiated Hamiltonian. If you work out the Green's function, you'll find out that it will have terms which describe something like a diffusion-like process and renormalization process, where the diffusion is coming from the kinetic energy and renormalization is coming from the interactions. So we can actually try to do it in the following way. The wave function will be sampled by points in three and dimensional space, which we call random walkers. Okay, we'll establish a correspondence between the wave function and spatial density of these random walkers. If you want, you can consider the walkers to be the basis, and it is a set of delta functions in three n-dimensional space, and of course you can do that because these are eigenstates of the position operator. Okay, so you could say this is a stochastic representation of the wave function. And now the walkers evolve according to the propagator G, which is the transition probability, and you reach the infinite time limit by iteration, and this is basically, the in a nutshell, the diffusion Monte Carlo method. Now, one of the fundamental advantages is, I never said what H is, and it can be almost anything. So we have explicitly interacting electrons and ions, almost any other system or interactions. There are certain restrictions, but otherwise, almost anything is allowed. This is not dependent on that. Okay. Now, this the thing which I mentioned before is an exact mapping of the formal exact mapping on a statistical mechanical solution, except one thing, which is the fermion sign problem. And the fermion sign problem, I will not go into the details at this point, although I will talk a lot about that later. So in order to avoid the fermion sign problem, which makes it exponentially difficult, we adopt the so-called fixed node approximation, which can be formulated as follows. The product of the trial wave function and our solution is forced to be non-negative everywhere. It means that the nodes, places where the wave function is getting zero due to the anti-symmetry of the trial function, are enforced to be identical for our solution. Then these two functions share the common set of zeros, therefore their product will be non-negative everywhere, and the zeros are enforced as a boundary condition on solving the complicated differential equation, and therefore we replace anti-symmetry, which is highly non-local, by boundary, which is completely local and is very easy to enforce. Okay? Now, we end up with the quandary, what does it mean, this fixed node approximation, since fermion node is a very complicated object in general. If you have any wave function as a function of all the coordinates, the node is defined basically by this implicit equation, which gives you an idea that this is 3n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface. Okay. In at this point, we have no clue how good or how bad it is. But let's just follow the line of thought. One reason why the node has an important role in these types of methods is that if you know the exact node, then you are solving effectively a bosonic problem, and we know how to solve the bosonic problems in a very efficient way. Basically, in polynomial times, almost always. Not always, but almost always. Now, the exact node, of course, in general, is very difficult to find. It might look like an intractable problem. Let's leave this problem later on, since I will be actually talking a lot about it. But now let's have a look what the fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo can do. And first, just give you an idea how the calculation is done for those which are not that familiar with the approach. Basically, you define a Hamiltonian. Electron-electron interactions are kept explicitly. We most of the time work, although it's not necessary, it's a lot more efficient to work only with the valence electron space using pseudo potentials or effective core potentials as they are called in chemistry. We are extremely cautious about the accuracy of the pseudo potentials which we use, since that defines the accuracy of the Hamiltonian, and we always try to make sure that the Hamiltonian is more accurate than the systematic errors which will come later. Now, yes?
Can you say something about that? Because you have to use local
pseudo potentials,
right?
No. Basically, we use non-local pseudo potentials exactly as they are used in one particle theories or DFT or whatever. There is a whole methodology how to treat those, and everything has been worked out after about 10 years, you know, having upper bound property and how to deal with the non-localities. All is understood. It's technically very complicated, as it was always also within DFT, but fundamentally there is no problem. Okay, the sizes. One can do up to few hundred valence electrons, okay? So which means few tens of atoms. Basically, well, I will show how that goes. The simplest type of the trial wave function, which you can use as later gesture types, so you have the determinants of the one particle orbitals times the correlation, it includes some parameters and stuff. They are all variational and technical, so let's keep those. This is not the only form which you can use. We actually have a lot more sophisticated stuff in now. BCS wave function based on pairing orbitals, Pfaffians, which are generalization of the BCS, backflow and stuff. Well, I will mention some of those later. Orbitals are coming from Hartree-Fock, DFT, hybrid DFT, possibly CI. They can be represented in any basis set which you want, combination of basis set, it doesn't matter. okay? It's actually relatively easy to code, and we have a bunch of options coded in the code that everybody has. That's the easy part, actually. For solids, you need to use supercell because this is a real total energy method, so you need to get the infinite size limit, so you need to work out finite size corrections. Again, some technical issues in there. Nevertheless, most of that has been understood and one can do safely extrapolations to infinite size. So let me give you a simple example, okay? So we take a solid silicon, that's the easiest perhaps element for the electronic structure. We know how it works, what does it entail. And so we do the calculation up to 214 atoms in a supercell to get the cohesive energy of the solid. So you are comparing the energy of the atom, 3s and 3p valence states here, with the energy of a solid, okay? Here we can get the exact energy basically by a brute force, either by diffusion Monte Carlo combination wave function with CI expansions, namely expansions in determinants, or by CI coupled cluster, whatever. This is a few electron problem, that's not a big deal. But if you take the plain vanilla version of the method, okay, single determinant, you do the fixed node calculation, you get the total energy of the atom with the accuracy roughly 0.03 electron volt, okay? This is the error which you have. If you do the solid and you repeat the same thing with a single determinant, you filter out all the finite size corrections and all that stuff, you end up with the following, where your energy is essentially above the exact energy, which we estimate from taking the exact atom and experimental cohesion, okay? And we compare that. So if we take that, we don't know anything about the experiment, we just try to evaluate an upper bound for the total energy, then we get rigorous lower bound on the cohesion. It's this nice number. If we do the error cancellation so that we subtract those two, we get this number, and it compares like this with the experiment. Okay, so we have a method where we can actually calculate rigorous lower bound on the cohesion within the accuracy of the Hamiltonian and all that stuff. And basically you see the level of accuracy which we are getting. And this includes both stochastic error bars, they are essentially invisible on this picture because they are so small, and systematic errors which come from the definition of the Hamiltonian fixed node errors and all those things. So these are essentially, yes?
Finite temperature corrections, are they taken out of the experiment?
I mean, this is all zero temperature calculation, so we have only zero point motion out, yes.
That was the same question.
Yes.
What do you do with the zero point?
I mean, these are calculated in mean field and subtracted out, so this is pure non-zero point, infinite mass is Hamiltonian, yes. I mean, one can play with the thing as well. But anyway, this is just to have an idea. So this is where you are. So we're getting to 30 millivolt accuracy on easy systems, okay? Something more challenging and more, yes, please.
Just a simple question. What about geometries? I mean, the energies are perfect, and what about the lattice constant? For the easy system.
If you wait a second, there will be a lattice constant here. So let me get into a more complicated case, which took us some time to do, and we all know that this is much more difficult. So if we were interested in iron oxide solid because of a number of reasons. One is that it was interesting high pressure physics because there's a lot of it in the lower mantle in the Earth, and there are umptillion papers have been written about the system. So we all know that there is a very serious difficulties in that type of a solid, because you have a competition of the Coulomb exchange correlation, all three of them are big. Still, on the top of it, you have crystal field effects and a number of other things. This small distortion because the D5 and cubic symmetries don't play together very well, so you get rhomboidal distortion and stuff. Now, I just take a plain density functional methods. If you actually look at this, and you do the say PBE or GGA or LDA calculations, surprisingly, you actually, even the equilibrium structure doesn't come out right. You get actually this one, which is a high pressure phase of the iron oxide as a ground state, and this one, which is a genuine ground state, will be slightly somewhat higher, okay? Now, of course, if you take at the right structure, you enforce the right structure from the experiment, and you calculate it in, you know, GGAs, LDAs, whatever, you get a metal, and this is well known, okay?
So, do a calculation for...
Okay, just a second, I'm getting there. So in order to start to reconcile theory with experiment, one needs something like Habardieu, or you can mix in exact exchange exactly as you suggested into the effective Hamiltonian. Of course, it is non-variational, certain arbitrariness is there. You see what happens, you put 10% of the Hartree fork, suddenly the slope was like this, that was the wrong structure, now it gets like this, and you crank it up a little bit better, and you are getting closer to experiments with 20%, but of course you are never, I mean, I don't want to say anything nasty.
21.3.
Wait. Actually, you need a lot more in this case. So that's what makes it very interesting. But anyway, let's try to compare. So this is the FDPB functional, okay? This is the fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo, and this column is experiment. So the difference between the ground state, equilibrium structure and a high pressure structure, in DFT you get a minus sign. I mean, we get half an electron volt, and we don't know exactly what's going on in the experiment because that phase is not easy to observe at equilibrium condition. I mean, that high pressure phase is not easy to observe at equilibrium conditions, even more difficult to measure. The collision, roughly, it's about 11, which is not too bad for the DFT. Note what is the collision which we can get, and let me be modest, okay? There is no comparable correlated wave function method which can give you this accuracy on the cohesion, period. Okay, now the equilibrium lattice constant. So what we did in here, not really forces, but a dependence on total energy on the whole thing, found the minimum, and this was the lattice constant which you get, which is also highly non-trivial in these cases. It's a little bit subtle. They are not coming out perfectly right with standard DFT. The bulk modulus is also reasonable to compare, and now there is the optical gap, which, I mean, there are discussions, a lot of discussion actually, about iron oxide, because it never comes stoichiometric really in experiment. There is a little bit of a stuff in there. Therefore, this number is kind of a reasonable ballpark, although they see tiny peaks at some lower energies, which are probably related to, I mean, that's a complicated question. But basic band gap is believed to be this one. That compares in this way with our estimation. As you see,
estimate the optical gap, can you tell us?
That's exactly right. That's a great question, what Robert said. So basically how you do it, this is a total energy method, okay? So you don't get any, nominally you don't get any spectral information. So what you do is essentially, well, let me draw something like a band structure, and this is the valence, and this is the conduction band. And within the given supercell, say we have occupied these K points within these given with the given occupation of the K points. So what we do is actually we have to compare two total energies. So we take, say, electron from this guy and put it in here and build a new wave function. It's a new excited state, okay? It's almost like a photon-assisted optical excitation. And so basically we are trying to do exactly something which is very close to what the nature does. Nature has no clue about the spectral properties, one particle energies. This is all our invention and basically the way how to understand it in an easy language. Nature knows only total energy. One total energy, you hit the photon, another total energy, period. So this is exactly what we do. Take one total energy, the other total energy, subtract it, and we call it optical gap.
You also study the way it approaches in the diffusion process, the ground state. That is better.
That would be, one could basically get some spectral information. I mean, yes. that's exactly right, because if you hit it, the photon, it doesn't go into a nice state, definitely not in this material. Yes. You get a kind of a spectrum, you get satellites, all the stuff. One can do it, although that is not polynomial scaling stuff. So one gets immediately into the real, or at least we don't know about the algorithm which would scale nicely. One can do it, but it's very expensive. So that's one of the things which I wanted to discuss. Yes.
So this, for clarity, there is also no indirect gap here. So this is a direct gap.
So this is an indirect gap. You can do also direct gap. I mean, one can do excitation like this. There is no fundamental reason why not.
Are you going to say something about the supercell aspect of the calculation then? Because you fold.
You fold, so you can choose. I mean, there are a lot of things, but basically one can, let's put it in a simple footing. You can always define the right spatial symmetry and spin symmetry state, both ground and excited. And therefore, you can actually measure how you go from this state to that state.
Could you do the same sort of rough treatment for the DFT calculations?
Basically, yes. One can do. Absolutely.
And get some number.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can do. And you get a little bit, well, I mean, I'm not specialist, and I just tried it for the purpose which you mentioned, you know, what it would do. And it, yes? Okay, so, and what it does, or at least what I have seen on simple systems, is that it gets a little bit more reasonable than actually the eigenvalues. Okay, the energy difference gets a little bit more reasonable. Well, in this case, right. In this case, you need other things in there. You need Hubbard U. You need something else to actually open the gap. I mean, it's well known. Yes.
I'm confused about the gap. So how do you know whether this transition is allowed or not?
Because you know the symmetry information. I mean, if it is. Pardon?
You have all this information, didn't you?
Yes, you have all the... Yes, so, I mean, it's a hard work to look at the symmetries and all the stuff which are really the points which you occupy, but you can do it because you have all the one-particle information, so you can figure out the symmetry of the determinant and you can figure out the symmetry of the state. Yes?
Could you do energy plus one and energy minus one?
Yes, you could do that. People did it. There are subtle points about how you do the thermodynamic limit in that case. Since in this case, the thermodynamic limits are very easy because it's kind of you have the same number of particles, therefore the scaling is very clean and you can easily, you know, subtract the finite size errors. If you do minus and plus, you get different finite size errors and it's a lot more difficult to filter out the finite size effects out of the whole thing.
Do you have, in this case, do you have some electron hole coupling?
Yes, you do. Absolutely. There are the excitonic relaxations are included within the fixed mode approximation. Yes, you automatically get included the electron hole relaxation processes.
But how do you do that? I mean, where's the hole?
Well, all is there. All is here. So I should draw it differently. So this is the hole, and this is the occupied state. Yeah.
Oh, you took it out.
I took it from here and put it there.
Okay. And recalculate.
Thank you. I'm sorry that I wasn't clear.
You had an indirect transition?
Yes.
But it obviously should be direct.
Of course. I mean, this was just an example. So I said that I can do also this, since there is no fundamental difference.
2.8, did you do a direct?
Yes.
Would you be able to find a mod transition if there is one?
Actually, yeah, I will come back to it. Okay, yes.
Would you be able to find a mod transition if there is one?
I mean, we hope yes, although we do not have an easy hand-waving the calculation. Why not? Every supercell calculation which you do, no matter what, will be an insulator with a tiny gap which will be decreasing by the size of the other thing. Therefore, you will need to be very careful about extracting the thermodynamic limits in both regimes. And since we never did it explicitly and demonstrably, I'm not saying how great it will be or how great it will not be. Fundamentally, it's possible. I'm worried a little bit about the extrapolations to because this is very subtle then. But fundamentally, you don't do anything different. Say, if you know the scaling laws to the thermodynamic limit, you can extract the quantities exactly like from simulation of the Ising model. Since this is just a very complicated statistical mechanical model. Yes.
Usually, the stretch things relative to LDA. Did you run LDA and find a smaller lattice constant? Usually it overstretches things, right? Here the lattice parameter is smaller than the experimental number.
Right. We didn't play too much with that aspect. We just wanted to, right.
Yeah, okay.
We just wanted to. Okay, so can I continue? That's a wonderful discussion, so we should continue in the discussion as well. So these are EV curves for those two phases. One can actually construct, the tangent construction and go through Helmholtz energy and find out the PV diagram. And this is it for that equilibrium structure, and this is for the high pressure structure. And these are data points from actual experiments. So this one is almost perfect. This one is not completely perfect. And of course, it would be strange if it was completely perfect, since stoichiometry business and other things at high pressures are not that perfect, crystal clear as we have it in our calculation. So this is essentially the model calculation, and the agreement for us was phenomenally good, okay, in the sense of what we expected. The transition was roughly 65 GPAs, which is less than they see in experiment. Experiment is about 7 to 100, and there are discussions where the number actually lies because of complications from experiments. The more recent things are inching upwards, so 100 or something. But the stoichiometry business is not clear, and there are other issues with the experiment. So definitely, as far as we can say, the clean, ideal crystal which you have looks roughly like this. Okay. Plus minus 5 GPAs within the fixed node approximation. Now, what is interesting and why I mentioned the hybrid functional yesterday and the whole thing. The orbitals which we got put into this thing were actually from hybrid functionals. And the reason was the following. We really tried to understand what's going on as we change the percentage of the exergartifog in the whole thing. And we basically did this. This is the weight of the exchange in PB0x functional, where x is this weight. And you see, we just plug the orbitals, so it's a single parameter family of orbitals. We plug those and evaluated the total energy. And we found that around 0.2, there is an interesting minimum. If we did it at different pressure, it was still within the 0.2, within the error bars. The minimums were not particularly sharp. They were reasonably flat. And so then we decided 0.2 seems to be like the best compromise, which gets the minima everywhere. So what we actually vary in transition metal oxides is, in some sense, DP hybridization. In hydrifog, you get an ionic picture. In DFT, you get a covalent picture. This is the parameter. But note what we did, okay? This is not an empirical stuff anymore, because we take the effective Hamiltonian, plug it into the variational method, and we find what is the minimum for that given effective functional within that parameter. In fundamentally, well, it's the variational optimization of the DFT functional. And this is a perfectly valid thing to do. I'm allowed to generate any orbitals or beneath the surface of the sun, plug them into the diffusion Monte Carlo. As soon as I find lower energy, I'm fine. Yes.
Have you done that also for other system? I mean, how?
Right. If it is so far what we see, it looks very consistent. In the first two rows, which are the simple systems, you don't see much of a difference because they are almost the same. In transition metal oxides, what we have seen so far, it seems to be very close to this picture. Say, we took manganese oxide molecule. We saw exactly the same thing, even looked at the orbitals. And you could find out that the orbitals are, you know, they are ionic here, they are more covalent here, and there is an optimum point, and it's the lowest energy. So it looks really nice in that sense for this. Yes. Roughly point around 0.2, somewhere in there. So I would say that it is a fundamental, you know, there is a fundamental message in that point, which tells you that some fraction of the exact exchange should be there, and it is genuinely non-local, and it should be genuinely non-local. The other large part of the, surprisingly large part of the exchange, actually can be smoothed out, and it's actually much smoother because the correlation actually does that. And I'm sure Kieran and other specialists in DFT know this. So basically, just to repeat, so we variationally optimize fixed node DMC energy. The orbitals are beyond artifact, they're closer to correlated orbitals, something like, you know, which you get from the correlated theories. And because they catch all the what I call bosonic correlations, namely correlations within the nodal domains, okay? And those are captured exactly. And so basically, there is a new variational, you know, method. You can define any effective Hamiltonian with the arbitrary number of variational parameters or parameters. It doesn't matter. If you are able to optimize them within the fixed node diffusion Monte Carlo method, then you have a method which is perfectly variational. And your Hamiltonian can be anything. It can be local, non-local, it doesn't matter. As soon as you are able to get the lower energy, you are closer to the fundamental solution.
Maybe you could also start from another point of view. I'm doing not hybrid functions, I'm doing LDA plus U. When I optimize my U,
it is
this.
It is exactly right. I mean, I think that the next view graph will be actually in that spirit. Because what we did then, so we optimized the ground state, okay? But then you get your effective weight, you can get effective U, or even more parameters than one. And then you come back to the spectrum. You recalculate with that optimal parameter, you get the spectrum, and really at roughly 20%, you see that the gap is getting reasonable. It's around 3 electron volts or something. I mean, it's never perfect, but it's reasonable, okay? So the one particle eigenvalues from these theories are more reasonable than either this one, which would be, you know, pure DFT, or up there, Hartree-Fock, obviously. And this is nice because we didn't optimize for the excitations or anything like that. We optimized only the ground state, and so it is sending you a message that the Hamiltonian is actually reasonable in that sense. Okay, so this is a little bit on the questions which you might have, you know, how costly or how, you know, how efficient the whole thing is, since I skipped all the technical details, and there are many, okay? But I consider it to be just the, you know, text which you need for accuracy. So we use neon core relativistic pseudo potentials on iron. The orbitals you have seen, the sizes were up to this one, finite size correction. This was the Slater Gestrel type stuff. Scaling in this region of accuracy and fluctuations is like this. Computational cost is significant. Typical calculation, one point on the curve, EV curve, would be about 20,000 hours, 30,000 hours, sort of, that is the sort of thing. So with 1,000 processes, it's one night. So, I mean, it's not too bad. Well, somebody... well, somebody said, and that was right, 20 years ago, DFT was a supercomputer problem. Now you can do it on your laptop. I think that Ron Cohen said it. So QMC, you'll be doing on your super laptop in 10, 15 years. Okay, so that's the right perspective on this. Now, what do you get? Well, so you are 2 to 3 orders of magnitude slower than typical DFT, because it's obvious that's a laptop problem now. So the...
Sorry.
Yes.
I'll be running DFT on my cell phone.
even better. Well, you know. You know what is the fundamental goal of these computational stuff? That you don't need even to do it. You will know what the result will be. So that's the fundamental. You need understanding, not numbers. Numbers are secondary. So what do you get for it? If we call the correlation energy the difference between Hartree Fock and exact, and this is the one of the very important points in here, you typically, of course, you never know exactly, but typically the ballpark value is you get 90 to 95% of the correlation energy. So this is what you can get. And of course, if you do then, you know, the relative energy, say, of two systems, part of this error cancels out because it's similar in both systems, and then you get accuracy 1 to 3% in comparison with the experiment for all the quantities, well, which I call these quantities robust quantities, optical gap, cohesion, some really big numbers, some half an electron volt and up. So practical calculations with hundreds of electrons are feasible. Now the agreement with the experiment within a few percent. What I love on this particular project is that we use the simplest plain vanilla QMC thing, single determinant, no bells and whistles. I'll talk a lot about it later. So no ad hoc parameters, no Hubbard U, no Stoner J. All the parameters which are in the thing are variational. So, and it, not only that, I mean nanosystems, BCS condensates, you say trions or something. It's the same thing. I mean wave function, Hamiltonian, you know. So I love this perspective on the whole thing. It's wonderful. If I'm spending on something my time, it better to be good. So so let me start to go dig deeper, because these were some easy stuff, you know, cohesion and things. So 90, but this is actually very interesting message for just about anybody who is doing anything which has to do with the electronic structure calculation. 90 to 95% of the electronic correlation effects are bosonic-like, okay? So they are defined within the nodal domains of the wave function. They have nothing to do with the fermionicity. These are pure bosonic correlations because they are really within the nodal domains. And the true fermionicity effect is actually 5 to 10% of the correlation energy. It's very, very subtle. And I'll go deeper into that when talking about the nodes. So the fixed node approximation is the only key issue. It's about 5 to 10% of the correlation. It doesn't bother us too much on cohesion gaps and stuff, but it is still a very important quantity when we talk about the more subtle stuff, magnetic effects, superconductivity, all those things. So that's something in which I'm very much interested. This is basically a working method. It can be computationally demanding, demanding on human time, and so on. Lots of technical stuff in there, but this is actually what I'm interested very much.
Can you explain what that means?
Yes, I will. This is what is coming. This is what is coming. So, beyond the fixed node approximation, fermion nodes. First, we need a little bit of an introduction into these subjects. So, what is fermion node? You take the wave function equals zero. You define d n minus one dimensional smooth hypersurface. It's smooth almost everywhere. So, it divides the space into domains with constant wave function sign. Okay. Now, the interest of nodes goes back to David Hilbert and Lauren Courant, and they proved some things, but those are too weak of the statements which they actually cleared. So first, we are interested in nodal topologies. How the nodal domains, how many of them are there, how do they live, how they are connected, and things like that, since it is very important both technically for correct sampling of the configuration space and fundamentally as we all see. Accurate nodal shapes, how you can describe efficiently or improve the things from, say, Slater gestural wave functions. What are the correspondences between the nodes and types of the wave functions which you are using, and also nodes and physical effects. Okay, so let me do a little bit of a crash course on the nodal stuff. So if you take, first on the topology, if you take a one-dimensional system, okay, we know that immediately that there will be n factorial domains. If I have two electrons and I do this, okay, the electrons have to go through each other. Therefore, you have n types of ordering, n factorial types of ordering of n particles on the line. Therefore, each time you cross, you must go into a new nodal domain. Therefore, there must be n factorial domains. Now, in higher dimensions, things are dramatically different. Okay, if you take, we know exact nodes of special cases of two electron and three electron atoms, and you will find out there are only two nodal domains, although you have, say, three times three dimensional space. How is that possible? So if you take helium atom triplet, 1s, 2s state, the exact node you will find out is the five-dimensional hyperboloid in six-dimensional space. Okay? And we found this one about 3 years ago. If you take a quartet, 4s, 2p3, which is the lowest quartet of asymmetry and odd parity, so it's the lowest state within the symmetry class, the exact node is given by this mixed product. And it's again some special hyperboloid, and you can show that there are only two nodal domains explicitly. Not only that, if you take basically the non-interacting cases, or we take spin polarized system, if you have a spin polarized closed shell ground state given by a Slater determinant, whose components are monomials in the powers of the positions, or homeomorphic maps, which maps you into this form, then there are only two nodal cells for any dimension larger than one. And that can be proven explicitly. It's amazing that it works for all the fundamental models which we know from quantum mechanics, like homogeneous electron gas, fermions on a sphere, atoms, and so on. So essentially, what this does is the node bisects the many body configuration space into two domains only. So all the pluses are connected and all the minuses are connected. Hand waving argument why this is the case. Think about the difference when I have no node and when I have node. When there is no node, I have a bosonic state. When I have a node, I have a fermionic state. The difference between fermionic and bosonic state is huge. Therefore, node is very expensive on the energy because you have to curve the wave function and run it through some zero somewhere. So if you do that, you pay a lot in energy. So hand waving, minimizing the energy, nature wants as little of the node as possible. Therefore, it only bisects the configuration space. Okay.
When you go to two dimension, so you're saying what happens there? Because
two dimensions is the same as three.
Ah,
Why is that?
Because in one dimension, well, the fundamental reason is in one dimension, if you want to exchange two electrons, you have to go through each other. In two, you can go around. That's enough of a dimension to avoid each other. Yes?
Maybe this is a little bit off topic. I mean, I guess one's not including spin orbit coupling.
No. At least not yet. I mean, I will not mention that. That's another, because you get an orthogonal space into the whole. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because then you have SU2 times the real space, and then it gets a lot more interesting. But that's a correct point. This is all just focusing first on the just position space. But
it's still a nodal structure there.
There is, but it's a lot more complicated. The next generalization, which since you mentioned that, if you go into a system which has a current, so the wave function is not real, but it's complex. One can generalize it into a phase and the amplitude, which is non-negative everywhere. And the generalization of the method is called fixed phase method. So you design a wave function, you take the phase, enforce the phase, and you have an upper bound.
That's much more restrictive
because you have the whole space instead of a subspace of zeros. Surprisingly enough, if you do calculations, say for a fractional quantum Hall effect, very, very efficient and very accurate actually, say using Laughlin wave function. So obviously that generalizes into a lot more complicated spaces if you start to do spin orbit coupling, absolutely. But it's not completely hopeless.
Dynamic and mean field theory, the infinite dimension plays an important role. The question is, can you prove something on the node structure?
Essentially, yes. One simplifies the whole thing tremendously in infinite dimensions, and then the nodes, well, I would say that this is actually the thing which I showed before, actually a little bit more, because here you can go actually to infinite dimensions, and you can figure out, for arbitrary number of particles, it's the same thing. Anyway, so let me continue. This is actually interesting because of the following reasons. So far, I was talking only about spin polarized cases, so all the spins were up. Now we'll try to switch on the another spin channel, and not spin orbit, but still interesting. So if you take the two spin channel, and I mean singlet, of course the Hartree-Fock thing is the product of spin up and spin down. So this has two domains. This has two domains. Product must have four. Okay. Now what happens if you switch the interactions on? And this is really cool stuff, I showed this explicitly. If you switch the interactions on, infinitely small amount of interaction, generically what happens is, because if you have the singlet, you know, the spin-up domains are exactly the same fundamentally like the spin-down domains, therefore you have degeneracy in the domains, you switch on the interaction, of course the degeneracy is lifted, and actually the topology changes, and four cells fuse again into the minimal two. One can show this by using BCS wave function and the first order perturbation theory that in generic cases, almost always this happens. So this is actually a very cool picture, which I like. The bosonic ground states are, of course, global all-electron S-waves. We knew that, nothing new in there. But the fermionic ground states are global all-electron P-like waves. Namely, they divide the space into two pieces, and those pieces can map into each other. So it's a fundamental generic property of the fermionic states. Okay, what is even more exciting, I don't want to go too far into this stuff, if you take a temperature density matrix, you sum over the whole thing, you fix R prime, beta and stuff, you can define again the nodes, and you will find out that actually even the density matrix fulfills the whole thing, which is difficult to understand in the beginning because this is summation over the whole spectrum, okay? It's not just a single state. It's a summation over the whole spectrum. Still, it is like that. Why? Well, the density matrix fulfills the similar equation, Schrodinger equation as the wave function, and of course the same principle applies. The fact that you have another parameter in the whole business, which is temperature or, you know, imaginary time, doesn't change fundamentally the whole thing because it just actually opens more of a variation of freedom in there. What nature can do with the nodes to minimize the energy. So
smokers, I gave this talk some time ago, or at least part of it. So he told me, so what you are saying is that the nodes are simple. Well, I never said it. I said only that the topologies are simple, and the shapes are not, and the better wave functions are crucial. So now let me show you a nice example. What happens with those nodal structures when you switch the interactions on? So the simplest case which I was able to come up with of the nodal topology change coming from interactions which can be visualized is this one. We have three electrons in Coulomb potential, okay? So the lowest state for spin-polarized quartet is of S-symmetry and even parity, and there are actually two states which are degenerated at the non-interacting level. This is one determinant, this is second determinant, and you know, in order to get the S-symmetry you need three of them. Now in non-interacting case they are exactly degenerate, of course due to the Coulomb spectrum. Now if you switch on the interaction any type, even Hartree-Fock is enough, they all split, but the nodal structure of the whole thing, you can work it out explicitly, is like this, okay? And it has six domains, and this contradicts what I said before that it should be only two because we are in three-dimensional space. There are six because of too many symmetries imposed on the system. So
in total, for the symmetry is also here, so there are so many symmetries that actually
the ground state is such, I mean, this applies to this state only. The ground state, which is lower in Hartree-Fock, is such that everything is S, even one particle orbitals are S. Therefore, it's quasi one-dimensional system. There are only radii are the relevant variables. All the other variables are unimportant. So you will find out that it's quasi one-dimensional. Therefore, it's 3 factorial six nodal domains. Now, what happens when I switch on the interaction? So this is how the six domains will look like. If you look from the right view in the nine-dimensional space, you would see something like this. It's actually a deep property that they must cut in pi over three angles and stuff like that. So these are all these R1 equal to R2, R2, and so on. Now, if I switch on the interactions and I write something like a Pfaffian or expansion in determinants, simply correlated wave function, I see these pluses here. There's an open channel here, and then they are open, so there are only two. Okay. So, yes. Back.
What's going on lower down on the right hand side?
Here?
It's behind the screen. It looks like things joined back up on the back.
So here it's joined here, and here it's joined here. So
there's a little peaking stuff.
I think that this is just a visualization thing.
So as long as you can go over that, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. I mean, this is only continuous transformations, yes.
Okay.
Any question? No. Okay, let me go. I have still lots of good stuff here. So I mentioned that Pfaffian, okay? Why Pfaffian? Why it is useful? How you can use it? What you can get out of it? It's a signed sum of all distinct per-partition permutations. So it is related to the determinant because determinant has permutations and it has signs, except that here you order them intelligently in such a way that you have only distinct pair permutations, and that allows you actually to say that if I anti-symmetrize product of pairs which are fermions, okay, and I have a certain number of those pairs, and if I anti-symmetrize, you get exactly the Pfaffian, okay? So in some sense you can say the determinant is a special case of a Pfaffian because each determinant can be written as a Pfaffian, but not each Pfaffian can be written as a determinant. So it's a more intelligent object than a determinant. What is important for us is that the Pfaffian algebra is similar to determinants. There are minors, there's all the stuff. The algorithm to evaluate Pfaffians is very simple, basically like almost like a Gaussian elimination. And Hartree-Fock is a special case of a Pfaffian, and you will see a point. So if I take my pair spin orbitals, so these we have spatial and spins also in here, so we decompose into the spatial and spin parts, and now by choosing appropriately these spatial parts, you can define a wave function which looks like this, which is very appropriate for PMC calculations. So you have triplet pairing, up, singlet pairing, the same counterparts in here, but you can also, you can expand the matrix by unpaired electrons if you want, unpaired channels, and you anti-symmetrize the whole thing, you will end up with a Pfaffian, which is very cool, because then you can expand the pairing orbitals here in a sum of one particle, these products from one particle orbitals. These are all variation parameters, lots of technicalities beyond it.
Valence bond state.
You can construct valence bond or beyond. I mean, basically, you can take the whole matrix, not only, say, 2x2 subspaces, but the whole matrix can be a variational space, which is both advantage and a curse, because it gives you some variational freedom, but it's very difficult to optimize. You have a huge subspace. So it's always kind of a compromise how I do that, or how one can do that. Now, note that BCS wave function, say, for the fixed number of particles, if we project from the grand canonical into canonical, for a singlet, is actually a special case of the Pfaffian. Essentially, is the determinant, but only of this piece, okay? This triplet pairing has been switched off, basically, and then you get a determinant. Now, the pairing wave functions enable to get the correct nodal topologies, as we as I will show in a second. But first, some results. So these are smaller systems. Obviously, it's a little bit challenging to apply it immediately to big solids or something. So here is the correlation energy recovered in the fixed node calculations from Hartree-Fock nodes, BCS nodes, Pfaffian nodes, and CI for these atoms with valence part only and these molecules on the first row as a testing suite. So you see in Hartree-Fock, whenever you have near degeneracy, of course you don't recover much because the single determinant is not very good. Here, there is not too much of a near degeneracy, so the energy actually looks good. Here it goes down, a lot of expansion in the determinant is significant, and so on. So if I switch on the Pfaffian, well, I get immediately more even behavior, and I'm almost systematically around 95%. It's never that good as CI, because here is hundreds of determinants. One thing which I want to note is this is the BCS node, and this is the Pfaffian node. This is the contribution of the triplet pairing. It's tiny always. We know that it's very tiny, but for nitrogen it makes a little bit of a difference because this is a high spin atom while the others are kind of an intermediate or singlets. Okay?
Gutzwiller, would this be an approximation to your Pfaffian?
In some sense, yes. In some sense, yes, although I would say this is even more cleaner than Goldsmith.
Not so that you can say I switch off certain elements in your Pfaffian and then you get Gutzwiller.
Yeah, one could make several mappings into wave function well, I'll come back after this view graph. So let's do it. Of course, exactly as you can, have one. Okay, exactly as you have one determinant and expansion in determinants, you can have expansion in Pfaffians. I mean, that's basic generalization. And you see here are the fixed node energies, percentages which we got for these three atoms. But now here we are comparing CI, so the number of objects here. These are three Pfaffians versus 98 determinants. Five Pfaffians versus 85. So you see about an order of magnitude decreasing of the expansion, because of course part of the correlation has been put into the wave function explicitly. And the percentages of the correlation energy can be almost the same. And we found that actually there is one-to-one mapping into singles and doubles expansion in CI from Pfaffians to determinants and vice versa. So at the second order level of the theory, you can make it completely identical. So that's maybe more general answer to the question which you had. Okay, and now the nodal thing. So these are the nodes of the oxygen atom. Now you have to a little bit, we need to build the understanding. So I fix the electrons. These are the green things, except one singlet. And that singlet, I put the up and down electron on top of each other, since that is not zero, obviously. And I scan the whole space. Okay. So obviously, I get the spin, the node from the spin up, node from the spin down, and you see that they cross. This is the same picture, just rotated so that you see what is in there. And of course, you see they are perfectly crossed. If I switch on the Pfaffians, channels between the plus is open, channels between the minus is open, and compare it with almost exact, this was the best which we could do at that time, this is the CI wave function. So you see that the same thing happens, there are openings between the minuses and openings between the pluses, but the structure is more rich than the structure of these approximate Pfaffian, although qualitatively it's right, okay? Topology is right, the shapes are not, obviously, and then you see that it's quite some way to go from these percentages to these percentages. Nevertheless, we do have at least an understanding where it is. We still don't know how to do that more efficiently, although there's a bunch of ideas still. One thing about the physical effects of these nodal things, imagine that you have a homogeneous electron gas, and there's a bunch of fermions in here, spin up, spin down, and I take again like one pair around, and I try to wind it around like this. If I have a Hartree Fock wave function, I have to cross the node, and I do, okay? If I have a correlated wave function, not necessarily I have to cross the node. Sometimes I need not to, and I can go with it pair around. In another way, this was the test on the unitary gas, from ultra-cold physics. There is the so-called unitary limit model, which is beautiful because the only scale is the density. Everything else is irrelevant. And it's fundamental in how you can get that. If you have a weakly bonded system, and actually you tune the chemical potential into such a way that it hits the zero of the binding potential, the lowest binding channel, then you get infinite scattering length, and then you get this unitary limit. Why it is beautiful? Because you get a huge fraction of the condensate there, unlike in real superconductors where you have a fraction of a percent of the electrons there. Here you have half of the system is in the condensate. And how do you calculate that? Not from any theories. You calculate off-diagonal density matrix elements of the second-order density matrix, and you find the limit up there. And maybe I should end up with this. So you have a particle, this is spin-up channel, and I want to exchange these two particles. This guy will come to this position, and this guy will come to this position. Similar here for the spin-up channel. If I do that separately, one and then the other, I hit the node, okay? Because I exchange really the two spins, so I must hit the node. If I do that simultaneously, not necessarily I have to hit the node. Here it's not visible well. So let me repeat what has happened here. So this red guy will come from here to there, and this guy will come from here to there. They exchange the positions if I succeed to run it again. Okay, so the red guy is exchanging with this one, and two black guys are exchanging. Now, you don't see that they didn't hit the node, of course. And the reason is that the visualization would require to sit on the electron as it flies through that space. But that would mean change the frame, change the view at each frame. So I would have to really create, in that stupid software, each frame from a different run. So it was a huge work, so I didn't get it done yet. But basically, if you actually would look at that in a different way, then you would see that. Now let me fast forward further. Okay. Okay. And I'm told that I should finish, so I will just put summary in here, okay? You missed the nodal domain averages, but anyway, that's cool stuff too, but I will be happy to explain that separately. And so basically, let me finish. This was just more of a practical type of a talk for the DFT community, which is interested in these types of things. So basically, you can treat explicitly correlated electrons at the level of few hundred and get the close to the Dirac dream, okay? Calculating almost exactly the eigenvalue of the Schrödinger equation. And besides that, I'm less maybe interested in the numbers. The fundamental insights, of course, are more exciting. I hopefully explained this sufficiently well. There is a fundamental property of the fermionic states that the fermionic state bisects the configurations of electronic coordinates. And nodal accounts are further related to other ideas in spectral theory. I didn't have time to talk about this. Now, if you want to do the calculations, our codes are open source. Anybody can do that. I always warn that it's a hell of a work, of course. There are no free lunches, but they are open and you can check them. They should be open to the scientific scrutiny. And this is my working hypothesis, okay? Thank you very much for your attention. It was fun to talk to you.
The reason I cut Lubach off was so that there are people who need to get away.
Yes,
get away.
Absolutely.
Likely, but we basically sort of run to lunchtime if we wish. So this is a really beautiful talk of many, many things that we haven't seen before, some practical things and some really beautiful systems that we know.
Yes,
practically. So, before you discovered this stuff about the nodal surface, one could do, of course, not release the calculation, but yeah. That is unstable, and so you don't get, you can do only over a short time.
So can
you take advantage in some way of the fact that you have, the topology to improve
Right, obviously. Actually, we are doing a little bit in that direction. Let me first correct a little bit, put it in the right framework, so to speak. You can do release node calculation. Namely, you release the constraint and let the thing run. It is fundamentally correct, although the efficiency is not guaranteed and it actually dies out exponentially fast. This is. But if you can afford that calculation, you know, there are many methods which are exponentially bad. If you can afford the calculation, it's a valid method, period. And it has been used. Actually, if you take homogeneous electron gas calculations, these are really not calculations 30 years ago. So obviously, it can be done if it was possible to do it 30 years ago. And of course, there are issues. And in fact, we are investigating this thing. And you get the trivial improvement. As soon as you improve the whole thing, you start from a lower point, therefore and that's the very fundamental one, because that is exactly where you are getting improvement. It can be used, and we are working actually with, we want to calculate the unitary gas exactly, basically. And there are things. Now, whether you can go beyond that, that's the difficult question. Can you improve some things? Yes, I mean, I had a little bit on that here, but there are no big discoveries yet in that vein of thought.
You would have to allow the nodal surface to change by retaining the same topology.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I didn't have time to talk about these nodal topologies, but this is one of the things which I have been working on, where you want to understand not the expectation values, and the reason is that if you have the expectation values, you know, the total energy provides very weak signal about the things with the way you change the nodes, obviously. Coulomb, you know, Coulomb is huge. The exchange is about 10% of the total energy. Correlation is about 3% of the total energy. Fixed node bias beyond Hartree-Fock is only 0.2% of the total energy. Therefore, variational methods per se are becoming less and less effective as you are, frustratingly, as you are becoming more and more accurate, okay? Because you don't see that signal. So it is very difficult actually to get that signal up. There are interesting aspects of it. If you think about these two states, they are degenerated in energy, but the nodal shapes are different. So you don't know it actually from the energy how the nodal shape looks. For these two states, it has even the same, symmetry, but the nodes are very different. So we want actually to measure beyond the usual expectation values. The energy is very robust quantity, and therefore you actually have almost no possibility of a signal. The signal is getting weaker and weaker. So, well, there are the suggestions that the nodes could be fractal, which is of course not right. But anyway,
be the nodal surface.
They will be the nodal surface. Perfect. So I try to look at the quantum field, not at the expectation value, because the expectation values, I claim, wash out all the information out. So if you take, say, stationary Schrödinger equation, and you assume that you have an exact many-body eigenstate, so you can define something like a nodal domain. So this is this plus nodal or minus nodal domain and corresponding node. Now you can integrate the Schrödinger equation over one domain only and use Stokes Green and you end up with something like this. Similarly for other domains, you get this object, which is kind of funny because you don't have a square of the wave function, you have absolute value of the wave function. So you have sort of one-sided expectations, as I call it. So you have the kinetic and potential components, okay? These are one-sided expectations. So they are defined like this, and this depends solely on the nodal surface, because here you have an integration only over the nodal surface and nothing else. So that carries clear nodal signal, or at least we hope so. Anyway, other features, it gives total energy, but it has no variational property because it's one-sided, okay? The surface integral might be potentially difficult to evaluate, but anyway, one can study this. And it's interesting to just try non-interacting atoms, say, with two electrons, and you will find out, for example, these two states, they have the same total energy, same kinetic energy, same potential energy, but over these nodal domain averages, they are different. Okay, and if you add these, you get the correct total energy, of course. Now, if you take these guys, again, all the components are the same, but these things are not the same, so it enables you to start to distinguish between those two cases. So this is along the line of searching for signals which are more finer than expectation values to find the information about the quantum field to find out how it needs to be changed in order to be right. Anyway, I don't want to go through more of this. Yes.
So, I'm thinking about the cost of the calculation and the algorithms, and I couldn't quite see
that's a perfect question. So essentially, so you build the wave function. Namely, you need to fill in n square matrix oscillator of the orbitals. Okay, so that's essentially proportional to the n squared. You need to calculate the determinant. That's n to the third power. Okay. But that is actually, the prefactor for the determinant is very small, so that is not important. Now, with the increasing size of the system, the fluctuations are growing proportionally to the n times sigma squared. So you get another factor of n to the n squared. And there is a price for the decorrelation as you are increasing size of the system, which is of the order of n to some small power, like 1/2 or something like that. So you end up effectively with n to the third or something, and then it depends on the implementation and particular system what it is. But it is basically low order polynomial, well, fully under the hood of that title.
But you said it parallelized too.
Yes.
But I don't know how well it parallelized. I mean, if we have 10,000 hours, we can do it in 10,000 processors, right?
That's right. So this is exactly what we are doing in some sense. This method is so brutally simple. In some direction, namely that you can do the stochastic sampling virtually independently Therefore, you can run these basically independent samples of the runs and collect the statistics at the very end. There are some subtle issues, but basically you can do it.
So 1 hour.
It is really, it's almost trivially parallelizable up to certain limit, then complications kick in.
Okay, thanks.
A question connected to that, sorry.
Yes.
Would there be any advantage instead of calculating directly the determinant, it is like diagonalizing a matrix, to use a stochastic...
The stochastic inversion? Yes. People were thinking about it, they started to hit that limit for very large
systems. If you have, for instance, an insulating system, you can use Vanier functions, and if you use a stochastic method, it should have a better scaling.
David Cepoli was looking into this. Of course, you need something like an inverse matrix.
Yeah,
and exactly. If the matrix is sparse in the real space, the inverse matrix is not necessarily sparse. And one needs special methods how to do that. But a stochastic inversion is possible as well. I mean, it's not a fundamental. If we one time we'll get to millions of particles, definitely the stochastic inversion will be much more efficient. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I have two questions. First question, so the approximation you make is using the nodal surface of a trial state. And you said this is a local, or at least
yes.
It's not a non-local problem, but even for free fermions, isn't the nodal surface non-local already?
No, it is local in the following sense. What I'm doing is essentially a trajectory of a delta function in three-dimensional space. Okay, I'm going like this, and each time I can calculate whether my trial wave function determinant is positive or negative.
Sure.
In that sense, it is local, because if there is a node, I know that I can't cross this, and that's a local property. Okay, anti-symmetry is not local. The wave function with this configuration of electrons has to be related exactly to the wave function with this configuration of electrons. That's a huge step in the configuration space. This is not. I come in here, there is a point, and that point is zero, and that's perfectly local.
Yeah, so only if you would, on that path, on that jump, cross the node twice, then that would be the small error you make.
I'm not 100% sure that I understand, but basically the anti-symmetry is essentially connection of the various parts of the configuration space where the points could be very far from each other, actually almost infinitely very far from each other. While here, when I have a configuration of electrons at this point, I always know whether I'm on one side of the node or on the other side of the node, and I can calculate it locally with arbitrary precision anytime.
But what I ask is if in this finite jump from on your path, you might cross the node twice in a small region.
Oh, I see. Perfectly correct. That's possible. For example, if you have curved something like this and you come in here and the gradient, yes, it's not too difficult to correct that. These are so-called finite size time step errors, and it's not too difficult to correct for that. Absolutely, that's possible.
So my second question then is about the finite temperature of full density matrix. Presumably at infinite temperature, zero beta, with both spins, you still have four nodal cells, and then if you decrease temperature at some point, the nodal cells merge into two?
That's actually a good question. I believe that the high temperatures, everything is connected, actually. This is a good question. This case, I strictly used the property that all the spins are aligned, therefore they were projected out, so it was only geometric part of the spin, all spin up cases. Now, what happens with the when you have two spins, I believe it will be connected at all temperatures, really.
And will be two nodal cells at all temperatures, even at infinite temperatures?
I believe so, yes. Okay. Yes, because you sum over the whole spectrum and therefore you have lots of determinants, so it's all connected. Yes.
Can I ask some clarifying questions?
Yes.
More to do with the first part, or more to do with the second part of the question. as a sort of practical sort of take-home message. I want to make sure I understand this right. If I have some problem, like an outside problem, and I know my DFT calculation isn't working, and I can afford the extra computer time, if I understand what you were showing correctly, you can think of, you have some ansatz for the wave function, right? You pick a particular one, you say right. What you're going to do, and then perhaps as a practical matter, the most important thing is really finding optimal orbitals, because the fixed node approximation is, you're going to get to 95% or whatever very, very easily.
Well, with some effort, yes.
Yes, but relatively easily, and going beyond that could be quite hard. But for many, many problems where DFT is screwing up, this will obviously get you, much more.
Something, yes.
And as a sort of tool, this work. And then, as you showed, if you fool with the orbitals, right, you can improve things. Is this...
People have been doing that in various forms actually before.
Sure.
Essentially, for example, Steve Fahey and Claudio Filippi and other people basically have methods. What is your, if you plug in the gestural correlation, you change, of course, the wave function. What is the most optimal set of one particle orbitals within the given determinant? Those methods are actually explicitly known.
Right. But it seems to be that you're saying that doing that and optimizing the orbitals gets you an awful lot of the way to sort of higher accuracy.
I mean, it gets you an awful lot of way, but there is only one minimum, okay, within one determinant. If you hit it, that's the end of the story, so you need to go beyond. So,
No, I understand that. I'm just thinking in terms of the practical scheme that people...
Right, I mean, so there is a practical scheme how to get the optimal orbitals with no regard to any theory,
where you started from,
No matter where you started from, just within the given mathematical object which you put as a trial wave function. Yes.
Okay, so at finite temperatures, there is this zero-point motion, and to estimate that, you need some estimate of the dynamical matrix.
Oh, yeah,
or something. Where do you get that from?
We can't quickly solve everything, like jumping to finite temperatures. In this thing is a little bit of a quantum leap, so you go into path integral realm rather than zero temperature in QMC. And that is a lot more difficult and less explored methodology. It can be done. Many of the things go there automatically. You can use fixed.
No, but when you presented some calculations, you said you made some estimates. I was asking really what you did there.
Yes.
Or you take that from a book somewhere.
We calculated in, the zero-point motion correction, we calculated basically within the DFT.
Oh, within the DFT. Oh, okay, thank you.
I mean, there was no dramatic...
My DFT works. I just wondered how.
I mean, in that sense, that if you are around that minimum and you want just the shape of that minimum, it's a reasonable approximation. It's a tiny piece on the top of the whole thing. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that we can't do zero-point motion. Right? Well, we declare the ions quantum particles, and the whole thing gets huge and messy, and you have two time scales and two energy scales, and you have to do it. So you get a hit by another three orders of magnitude, but fundamentally, nobody can prevent you to do that.
One more question.
Yes.
I heard a talk fairly recently by Sandro Sorella who was talking about, it seems like very similar things. Can you give maybe a little bit of perspective of what range of related methods are out there? How different is what you're talking about?
Well, this Sandro basically does the same thing as we are. A little bit smaller system. He pioneered the BCS wave function into these types of calculations. I pushed together with Kenishmit Fafias because it's a little bit more general. And they are doing similar types of things. Basically, the methodologies are similar. There are various things, how to make it more efficient, implementation types of systems which you can do and stuff like that.
Does Sandro do variational calculation with this wave function because it then has efficient scheme to do the variation. So I'm not sure if it does diffusion. I think it does variation as well.
No, I think it does diffusion as well. Mm-hmm. It does definitely. Michele Cassula and people did basically the same on smaller systems, benzene, iron molecule, things like that. So. So it's basically, I mean, it's getting now more widespread than it was, say, 20 years ago, because obviously some people find it attractive. So it's getting cultivated now in more corners, which is great, because obviously we need that.
One last point. There was a Fuser letter this summer from Rick Heller's group at Harvard, where they were doing something, I can't remember exactly what they called it, but their semi-classical approximations is what they specialize in. And they were just looking at model systems, but they did what they called a sort of correlated Thomas Fermi. I can't remember what the final name of the thing was. But they were trying to sort of do a sort of Thomas Fermi-type treatment, but on a correlated wave function. Mm-hmm. And they kind of couldn't get to where they really wanted to go. But what they found was that they could figure out reasonably accurate total energy for their little model system, but only if they could decide which of the states had the right fermionic symmetry. So they had several states, and if they knew which one it was, then they got an accurate energy, but they had no way of figuring this out approximately. So they might, you might be able to tell them rather easily in some sense.
I don't know whether easily, but it's not ruled out that we would be able to do that. So
noble structures, right? And so it might be that is actually some very simple answer based on.
I mean, I presented many things in kind of an off-handed way, although there was a huge amount of work behind the technicality, especially if you are thinking not the model systems, but you take a real material, iron oxide, and you want to say something to an experimentalist. That's a very long route actually to go, and then it's a lot of work. So small model systems are not easier, and definitely, but absolutely,
we already know the answer.
We might know at least good suggestions. Yes.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much all for coming. Yes, one more question.
One very last question. There was an idea about self-healing quantum Monte Carlo by co-workers.
Right, it's basically a method to improve the nodal approximations. And so in some sense, how you would do the, imagine that the wave function would have a large number of parameters. Say you expand into many determinants and you just throw in the determinant without thinking about symmetries or whatever. And
the basic premise of that was that there was essentially a kink developing in your wave function if you kept the node fixed where it was. So
I'm sure such effects would be there since it is a highly nonlinear problem then. But basically what they were trying to do, if you would have a diffusion Monte Carlo signal to improve your nodes, and you would have variational parameters how to get there efficiently. And then the nonlinearities they have seen along the way, I mean, that's probably what they have seen, yes.
My question is really, I mean, if you do a calculation and you have an old surface fixed, do you really see a kink in the...
No, I mean, because if you have a fixed node, you don't see anything because it just goes into a lower energy state within that constraint. It's a constraint, so you don't move anything. So you run the whole thing and...
But the constraint means that your phi zero should have a kink, I believe, at the node.
In what? Kink, in what? I'm not...
In space.
But I'm never touching the space because I define the nodes and the space is fixed. There is nothing to... Because they move the nodes, which is a different business. That's a different business.
They move this based on...
discontinuous
cylinder. Oh yeah, there are. Oh, absolutely. This is perfectly correct. So if you think about the fixed node approximation, and this is your restriction of the node, the derivative, if the node is right, the derivative from the left and derivative from the right will be exactly the same. Okay, that's well known, understood, that the derivatives do not match. Of course, that's well known thing. If you put the wrong boundary condition, of course, the derivative from this side will be different from the derivative from that side.
Very interesting, though, to see what that derivative does on average with your optimized exchange.
Oh, I see.
How close you actually get.
Sure.
In terms of the actual wave.
I mean, I didn't have time to talk about the backflow, which takes care of some of these things. And I claim that all the local correction to the nodal surface are actually the easy one. You know, to correct for the derivative, if the node is really a little bit shifted and you need to correct for the derivative, that's usually not that difficult, actually. A little bit of a release node would do it. There are other, more deeper things with the nodes which are not of this type. But anyway, that's for the next talk sometimes. So this is well understood. You're perfectly correct. So there is a drop in the derivative of the wave function across the node if the node is not exact. That is well known, understood. They try to improve it, but also within only restricted variation freedom because the wave function is finite. There is no infinite freedom, basically. If it is infinite freedom, then you go to what Roberto mentioned. You have release node calculation, and your efficiency goes down dramatically.
So on that point,
I believe that we exhausted a lot of time. Thank you so much for being patient and staying here.